You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good morning. Nice to see everybody here today. For those of you who I don't know, I don't have the pleasure of knowing, I'm Stu Ingus. I'm an attorney at the Venable Law Firm and focus a lot on internet-related issues in the policy context, and it's nice to see a lot of old friends and new friends and hopefully soon to be friends all in the room. I think we have a very interesting and timely panel today, and what we would like to do is to have the panel take up about the first two-thirds or so of the discussion and then open the discussion to questions. We've got a really distinguished group of panelists, and hopefully they can answer your questions, and we can have a very informed and enlightening dialogue here today. The title of our panel is Making Online Personal Information More Anonymous, Will It Save Privacy? And we're slated to look at privacy issues related to online advertising marketing and how users' personal information is gathered, stored, and analyzed and used. And then many online advertising companies are taking steps to make users' information more anonymous or perhaps less identifiable in an attempt to promote privacy. And so we intend to explore that issue, those issues. There's a lot of different issues that kind of swirl around in there, and we'll try and break them down for you. On our panel, just going down the row, we have Pam Dixon, who is the Executive Director of the World Privacy Forum. Pam founded the World Privacy Forum in November 2003. She also serves as the co-chair of the California Privacy and Security Advisory Board, which is a state-level board representing that reports to the California Secretary of Health. She also was formerly a research fellow with the Privacy Foundation at Denver University's Stern School of Law, where she researched and wrote about technology-related privacy issues, and she's a very prolific writer and speaker on many issues. Next to Pam is Michael Hinsey, who leads a team within Microsoft's Corporation's Legal and Corporate Affairs Group that focuses on regulatory and public policy issues, including privacy, security, telecom, online safety, and free expression matters worldwide. He's been with Microsoft since 1998, and prior to that, he was a lawyer at Steptoe & Johnson. Next to Mike is Ann Toth, who's the Vice President of Policy and Health, Vice President of Policy and Head of Privacy for Yahoo, Inc. Everyone knows who Yahoo is, and during her 10-year-plus career at Yahoo, she's managed a wide variety of policy issues, including privacy, community, user-generated content, child safety, advertising standards. She also currently serves in her Yahoo capacity on the board of directors for the Network Advertising Initiative and previously served on the board of the Internet Content Ratings Association. So as you can tell, we've got some very considerable experience on the panel here. And what we thought we would do is really try and form this as a dialogue, leading off with questions. I'll frame a couple of questions and toss it over to folks, and we'll go down the line and get some answers and kind of kick things off that way and see where we go. First question, I'll start with Mike, and then we'll go down over to Pam and then to Ann. The title of our panel asked the question whether anonymization of online personal information can save privacy. And I think it'd be helpful just to frame the discussion if we can just spend a little bit of time on what is the relationship between privacy and anonymity to begin with, just for everybody. Mike?
Sure. You know, when I think about anonymity or anonymization, I think about it in the context of an overall program to protect the privacy of the data that a company or other entity collects. You know, when you look at the traditional notions of sort of fair information practices, there's a number of things that are in there, including, you know, looking at the data you're collecting. Don't collect more information than you actually need. While you maintain the data, keep it secure, have information security programs around that. And then don't keep it longer than you actually need to keep it for a business purpose. But within that scope, and when you think about sort of what do you do to protect data while you have it, I think anonymization techniques are an important thing to consider. Now, sometimes you do need to keep the data in association with personal information. It does need to be identifiable because there might be, you know, billing systems or delivery systems where you need to mail something, and so you need the data associated with personal information. But there are other contexts, and ones that I'm sure we'll talk about later today, like online advertising and search, where the data doesn't need to be directly associated with a name or an email address or other information that would directly identify an individual. And so thinking about ways and different degrees to which you can anonymize data, I think, is important in that context. Another point I would make is that all anonymization methods are not equal. It's not a black and white thing where data is either anonymous or not anonymous. There's a wide range of techniques that you can use. It's really about separating, keeping the data separate from information, from personal identifiable information. And there's maybe some methods that are partial. There may be some that are more complete. There may be some that are reversible. There may be some that are irreversible. All of them may be appropriate in different circumstances, depending on the needs of the data, the business purpose for the data, and how far you can separate sever that connection. You know, there's words that are sort of thrown around like pseudonymization or anonymization, where pseudonym is sort of like replacing one identifier with another to sort of obscure the connection, whereas some people use anonymization as a more thorough means of severing that connection. So, it's helpful to think about it in that context, that there's a range of methods that are appropriate depending on the circumstances, and it does need to be thought about in the context of a broader approach to how you collect and protect data.
Thanks. Pam?
Hi. I'm going to be speaking for two people. I'm speaking for myself, but I'm also kind of... I was asked to talk about the policy issues related to anonymity and privacy. LaTanya Sweeney wasn't able to be here today, and she was going to talk about the science piece. So I'm going to put on my geek hat, which is really easy to do, I'm afraid, and talk about a little bit of both. So the frame I would put forward is just to think about this in a fresh way. There are a lot of intriguing myths about privacy and anonymity. One of the myths is that if you just simply take a database, and all databases are created kind of equally, and you remove PII, that you've done your job anonymizing data, and that's actually not true. What the case is that there are many kinds of databases. I think the databases the data sets that we're all really thinking about here today, though, are data sets called microdata. This kind of data refers to identifiable real people. The data hasn't been moved around enough to make it just simply a statistical database. It's a little bit of a different animal. So given that context, that we're really talking about data about people, not data that's just numbers, there are a number of very different ways to store the data and then to anonymize it. And the question is this. What does the database look like? And specifically, the question is not so much what personal information can we remove to make this less identifiable. The question is, what technique could be used to analyze this data that would cause re-identification? And this is a completely different approach to anonymization and privacy. And if you look at the current research, this is where the research has gone. In the past, even up to about a year ago, the research was saying, okay, what can we take out of the data to perturb it is the actual technical term. What can we take out of the data to make it more general so that we can't go in there and identify? Unfortunately, this really doesn't work as an anonymizing approach anymore because our computing power is just so great at this point. You can really take any good micro data set and identify people, even if personally identifying information is completely removed. One example of this, of course, is the Netflix data release. I don't know if any of you followed that, but it was a very interesting situation where Netflix, as part of its Netflix prize, they released over 1 million records of anonymized data. And they meant well. What they did was they used an old anonymization technique of simply taking out personally identifiable attributes or information. This doesn't work anymore because the algorithms have changed and computing power has much far surpassed that. So some researchers promptly re-identified the data. And they were able to go in and basically re-identify that data to a very high degree of confidence using a very minimal effort. So I guess the frame that I would say is that we need to shift our thinking about what privacy is. It's not about what we can hide. It's about more of what can we re-identify. And then the other thing I would mention is that some of what I think we're talking about with especially Microsoft and Yahoo and other companies that have a very high dimensional data sets, in other words, data sets of people's transactions and behaviors. When you have data sets like that, they're not often released to the public. However, there are different kinds of data sets that are routinely released to the public. For example, health databases for public health reporting. The Food and Drug Administration is looking at creating something called the Sentinel Network, which would be a drug reporting network that would be public-private, which would report quote-unquote anonymized data on prescription histories of people. So this kind of data has to have much greater scrutiny, I think, than data that's being held by companies where there's never an intended release. That being said, there is always the risk of privacy breach. But I think that's the general frame we're looking at.
Anne?
Thank you, Stu. So I think the title of the panel I thought was intriguing, the notion of can anonymity save privacy. And I think that privacy is something that really, I agree with Mike, it's, there are a variety of things actually that contribute to a consumer's sense of privacy, and anonymity may be one of those things. But for us, privacy is an issue that we use as in order to engender trust with our users. So for the last 10 years, I've been working at Yahoo and toiling in my cube, kind of just chained to my cube every day, working on these issues. And for me, privacy has been one of these issues that I actually kind of hope that wouldn't be an issue for Yahoo in the public sense, because for the most part, for the last decade, privacy issues when associated with companies haven't been issues that companies have embraced. They've been sort of issues that are generally controversial. But for the last year, I think that we've done a really good job of actually advancing privacy with a number of different things. And I think that anonymity is one of them, and we made an announcement last year about our data retention policy and anonymity. But I think there are a lot of different things that companies can do to engender privacy with consumers. I think when people think about the different aspects of privacy, I think most users think about it in terms of personally identifiable information. And so while we'll get into the different methods for how to anonymize data, I think the issue that we were grappling with is how do we remove identifiable data as soon as possible without degrading the user experience? Because there's a lot of value to consumers. There's a lot of value that can be driven by using data responsibly and using it in a way that is consistent with the user's expectations. So that's what we've been looking to do, and I think that this will be a really interesting discussion today.
Great. Thanks. Let me... Pam, you mentioned the healthcare arena, which is an area where there's a long history, a policy history of having data treated differently that's gone through a certain anonymization process. And I was wondering if, I'll just go in the same order, if you could speak to, starting with health and obviously go beyond that in other areas as you want to, but what are the reasons? What are the benefits? Why would companies want to anonymize data in the health area, for example? Pam first, and then.
Well, I think let me just begin by saying we've got to be really careful with what we say is anonymous. I think that if you look at the HIPAA language, the actual term is de-identification. And I think this is a more accurate way of saying what we're talking about here. Anonymization is a term with a lot of different definitions and very few statutory definitions. And I think that it's really a risk to say, oh, well, we've anonymized this data. Consumers may have an entirely different idea of what that means than what a company means, and different companies may have different ideas that they're promoting in terms of anonymization. I think that without a standard, as there is in de facto HIPAA, we've got to be really careful with that language. So, that being said,
Let me reframe the question. Tell me what the benefits would be in the healthcare arena and others to de-identify data.
Okay, de-identification of data allows use of the data set for other purposes. So, for example, I think the best example is public health. We want to know when people have some kind of communicable disease. It's a fair use of data to find that out, and it's legitimate use of data to find that out. But do we need to have the individual's entire health history? The answer is, well, you know, maybe. So when health researchers want to get these data sets, they want data sets with maximum information. However, patients don't necessarily want that. And so the compromise has been, okay, well, let's rip out as much data as we possibly can so that this person will never be identifiable to a researcher, and if that hard drive or laptop gets stolen out of a car or something, we don't want to identify patients, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the benefits. I'd say the other benefit is for companies that aren't releasing public data sets. So, for example, this would be more of a Microsoft Yahoo issue, would be, frankly, compliance with various financial and oversight regulations like Sarbanes-Oxley. Do you know where your data rests? Do you know what your risks are of breach? At this point in time, if you've got the technology and the computer scientists, you can go through data sets and you can achieve a metric, a privacy metric, a verifiable risk of re-identification of that data set. And that's really what we need to look at. So the benefit is you can put a number to what your risk of re-identification is. And, you know, that's not a bad thing to know. If your re-identification risk is 50%, I think that's a pretty... You know, that every company is going to have to come to their own decision, but that's quite crucial.
Before I move on, let's stay on healthcare, and then we'll kind of morph it over into the online advertising and some of the other areas. Just as a follow-up on the healthcare, I think you're raising a good point on, you know, analyzing the risks of breach. And I was wondering in the health environment, two comments. One, if you could, again, I think you quantified a little bit of the value, the societal value in various treatments and improving treatments, and you indicated that consumers don't want people to have all their records. I think it's fair to say, though, consumers do want the benefits of those various treatments, and so what I'm trying to line up is so you have the value, the benefit, in the policy balance here, the potential risk is that a consumer had their health information that they don't want somebody else to have available or seen. And I guess, could you kind of quantify your view of the risks in the health area and contrasting kind of where that, in your mind, the balance should lay?
There's really a couple of risk scenarios, and we've seen most of them play out already. There are probably new risk scenarios that no one's thought of yet that some entrepreneur will, so we'll have to keep an eye on that. But certainly one of the risks is the just standard old school, you leave a laptop in the car risk. We've had this over and over again. You've got, for example, do I dare mention it, in Washington, D.C., the VA situation. In California, we had an AIDS researcher leave an entire database of identifiable research subjects in his car. It was stolen. It was published to the web. It was really ugly. It was taken off, but not in enough time to prevent caching and all sorts of mischief. So the risk, of course, is the ultimate harm that those individuals can suffer. In the VA, it's one kind of harm. And when you have identifiable data that's been breached in a research, you really have an underwriting issue. You don't want this information to get in the hands of a medical underwriter where you'll be denied insurance. It's the one harm. Then, of course, employability is the other harm. So those are the two risks there. The other risk is one that's...
Let me just stop you. The first one was what?
Medical underwriting. So, for example, if you are known to have Huntington's disease and you've already undergone the genetic test, and you have that diagnosis, this pulls you out of the geno loophole, and you would be a medical nightmare to try to get insured.
But it is, just as a factual, I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but just so we're clear here, so is the suggestion that people should be able to hide their medical conditions when it's a condition of underwriting?
No, I think what the situation, that's a good question. The situation is right now is that people pick and choose there's what I would call procedural privacy in a lot of healthcare. People will disclose and not disclose various facts to various doctors. When you go to the dentist, you're not going to tell them about all of your conditions, and that's just human nature. And that is, that ability to control the information is a bit lost when it's been posted on the web. But what really this comes down to is secondary use. I think every threat scenario really comes down to how is this information that was originally promulgated for healthcare treatment purposes in a healthcare file, how is this being used in a manner that is not related to my healthcare? That's really the fundamental question that ends up getting asked and answered. And there's a lot of discussion about, use of pharmacological data, prescription histories, and that's a very hot topic right now because of some loopholes in HIPAA. And I think this is yet again another secondary use situation. So that's the risk.
The reason I'm asking is because I then want to ask, and then I'm going to push on to the next panel, but is solutions, right? So we have the benefits, we have the risks, and presumably I think you've indicated there are obvious benefits, and so you want to maximize the benefits, minimize the risks, and what are the potential solutions? And the reason I ask about your example of medical underwriting is, at least in that area, if the question is what should be used for medical underwriting, to me that's a policy debate about medical underwriting.
That's a big policy debate.
I want to make sure, and I'm going to now ask you, and then we'll move on. But what's your sense? Let's stay focused on the health area for a second. You've identified some areas of problems, some real factual situations where there have been breaches. Solutions in that area?
There are a lot of solutions. The problem is that very few can agree on which solutions to implement when and where. But there are a lot of good solutions, and I think that these problems are solvable. I think that there are a lot of new algorithms out there that are very helpful. I think there's a new approach that could be employed that's becoming at least is getting looked at. So, for example, let's talk about HIPAA for a second. Okay, under HIPAA, if you look at the de-identification standards in HIPAA, they're very proscriptive, and they give you point and click and, point by point, how to de-identify the data. Well, those were written under, I'm going to get a little bit technical, they were written associated with a particular kind of anonymization called K-anonymization. It's a particular kind of approach, which is to generalize the data and to sanitize it a bit. That approach has really, it's still an approach, it's still used, but there are a lot of risks when you use that approach today because people have discovered how to re-identify data even when you have done that. So a newer approach would be to say, okay, we have a database, and we want to retain utility of this database. We want people to be able to search it. So let's leave the sensitive attributes in the database, but let's restrict the searching. So it's an entirely different point of view. Instead of messing with the data set, you're really, really restricting the access and changing the access. But if you did both, if you changed the data set and did certain algorithmic wonders to it that assisted in de-identification, and you also worked on the data access side, I think you have a really good solution in the works.
So let me, just as I'm recharacterizing, I think what I'm hearing is technological type solutions, but there needs to be, you mentioned that the state of play even on the technology has changed in the last year. So I think there's a recognition there are technology solutions and the benefits, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done in the technology solution. But I don't hear you calling for, the risk is so great that we just forget about the benefit.
That horse left the barn a long time ago. Yeah, that horse is out of the barn. That's not the world we live in. But I do think that from a policy point of view, you cannot just throw up your hands and say anything is appropriate anonymization. That is really important to understand that we have to have definable standards of risk, definable standards of what is de-identified appropriately and enough for consumers.
Right.
We can't just say, oh, we've anonymized this, and then there's supposed to be all this consumer trust.
Let me stop you there, because I think that's exactly the point I want to build off of, which is I think you're saying you need to have a dialogue that we can define these various things. And so let me turn, kind of shift a little bit, because I think Pam actually made some of the points I wanted to tease out from all of you right off the bat. Maybe this is a good time. There has been a policy dialogue that's impacted both Yahoo and Microsoft in this area, both in terms of online marketing and search in particular, and the benefits have been kind of weighed against the different standards. So why don't you, with respect to your companies, talk about the benefits trying to preserve through the de-identification or pseudonymization, whatever framework, however you all decide to describe it, and the steps and measures you've taken, and maybe we can, after that, get into a discussion about where those steps are. Anne, first?
Sure. In our industry in particular, the discussion has been centered largely on search data. And a lot of the discussion has actually been driven out of the European Union and some of their concerns about data retention. So a little over a year ago, we announced a data retention policy, really a data anonymization policy around search data, and we announced that we would anonymize search log file data after 13 months. After that period of time, once we announced that, we actually went back and we challenged our engineering teams, and we said, really, is that the best we can do? Can we look at this more holistically? Can we really examine our data needs across our systems and really understand what we can do here? So we embarked on over a year-long process to really understand, how long do we need to keep identifiable data in order to serve consumer needs on our site, in order to run our business, in order to give consumers the sorts of things they're looking for? How long do we need to have it? And after a pretty thorough review, we came down to actually 90 days is about the period of time we think is appropriate. 6 months for certain types of data relating to security systems, fraud, abuse, system site security, that kind of thing. But when we came down to that window of time, we actually were employing a number of different steps to de-identify the data. So initially, I think there was a lot of discussion primarily around IP address and that being an identifier that's captured in our log files. And with that, a number of companies, and Yahoo included, announced that we would remove the last octet of the IP address. Well, that's one thing that we do, but we actually take incremental steps beyond that to de-identify the data. So I don't know how technical our audience is, but there are a number of identifiers that web companies typically include in log file data. Some are specific to your browser, the cookie. Some are specific to a user, so it's a different form of cookie there. If you have a registration type event with a user, you may store an ID in a different cookie. So we have both of those types of cookies, and we take additional steps for each of those cookies. So for the cookie that we store in our log files that relates to a browser, we one-way secret hash that identifier, so we obscure that data. There is a cookie that relates to a Yahoo user ID. We one-way secret hash that cookie, so that's the third step that we take, and then we truncate the last half of that identifier. And then the last step that we take is specific to search log file data, in that a number of people will input information in the search box that is personal to them. So we take the additional step of filtering our search query logs in order to remove common identifiers, things that might appear in a format like a social security number, a credit card number, an address, in order to make those records less identifiable, because there have obviously been issues in the past where that's come to light. So we take those four steps with respect to log file data. We hold the data for up to 90 days. In some instances, we actually, the data is de-identified long before 90 days. But then what we also did in our review was not just to look at search log file data, because that had been the focus of a lot of the discussion. We thought it made more sense to take a holistic approach to our log file data in general. So we're talking about page views, page clicks, ad clicks, not just search record data. So we expanded the scope of our anonymization or our de-identification process to cover the broad scope of data that we collect and interact with from users. So that was the process that we undertook, and I think it was, for us, it was very important to have a multi-layered approach, because I think simply truncating an IP address left other identifiers intact that we felt like we really needed to take an additional step with.
And one thing, maybe that was a good description of kind of the process and that you've taken to limit the risk. Explain some of the benefits as to why you want this information, why you have it to begin with.
Well, so as an internet company, users come to our site and they expect customized services. They increasingly consumers want what they want when they want it, in the form they want it, where they want it. And so we use data to provide those services. It was important to us not to degrade the user experience in any meaningful way. We use data in personal form to provide personal services to users. But when it's not necessary for that, it's actually beneficial for us to de-identify the data. It reduces our security risk, privacy risk to consumers. And there's a great deal that you can do with aggregated data that improves the services. There are a number of features. I think most people will, when they type a term into the search box, a search assist will pop up, and it'll give you hints about what might be helpful or what you might be looking for. That's doable because we have a lot of data about search patterns. We don't need to know who searched. We don't need to know an identifier about that individual. We need to have the aggregate data to be able to perform that analysis, to be able to provide that service to customers. That's true on the content side. It's true on the advertising side. So there's a lot of data that's incredibly useful. For us, we want users, obviously, you know, trust in a site, it's kind of our currency with users. If they don't trust you, they can go someplace else. It's not hard. So giving users a sense of assurance about their privacy is beneficial to us as a company. So if we can anonymize it sooner and still be able to offer the types of products and services that we have always offered, that's a win for us and that's a win for the consumer.
Okay, thank you. Mike, Microsoft has also been a leader in exploring different technologies, and the de-identification is probably the better word. If you want to rename it back to anonymization or pseudonymization, feel free as well. But why don't you, if you have anything on the benefits to add to what Ann said, start there and then describe the steps you've taken. I think, you know, the risks have been set forward, the steps you've taken in your protections, and if they differ from Yahoo's, explain that and kind of, you know, is it better to have multiple standards? Should we, you know, along Pam's line, do we really all need to figure out what the lockbox is? Touch on those things, please.
Sure. So in terms of the benefits, I think Ann spelled those out pretty well. I'd add a couple of things. One, we're both for-profit companies, and we want to avoid things like click fraud for the advertisements that are associated with search results. And so you need data that is at least unique on a per-user basis to be able to go back and audit and make sure that things like click fraud are not going on. It's also helpful to prevent against things like botnet attacks, denial of service attacks against your service. So there's a security element that the data is necessary for at a particular level of non-aggregateness, if that's a word.
Points anonymous, so you can.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just make up words here today. Improving the search service, being able to use the data that you have to run analytics on it over time to see what search patterns look like, to be able to improve the service and improve the results, which ultimately are what people want. They want the most relevant results that they're looking for. So those are the things I would add to the benefits. The approach we've taken is similar to what Yahoo's done in some ways and different in other ways. We've done a couple of things. We actually do something at the moment of collection that one might call de-identification, and that is, to take a step back, search engines don't exist in a vacuum. Both Microsoft and Yahoo and other search engine providers offer other services, some of which involve users creating accounts and identifying themselves. And so we do have personal information about many of our users of our search service. So the question becomes, are we associating putting that all in one big bucket? I think the answer for us at least is no. But what do we do to sort of de-identify it and make sure those two buckets are actually separate? So from the moment of collection, we actually do a one-way hash on the identifier to make sure that there's an anonymized identifier, maybe that's not the right term, but that's what we call it internally, associated with search terms. So those are separated from the beginning, from day one. And then at a period in time, for us it's currently 18 months, we go through a much more rigorous and what I would argue is complete method to actual anonymization, not just de-identification, where we are deleting the entirety of the IP address and the entirety of any cross-session identifier that would allow you to link search terms over time. And the reason we focused on both the IP address and any other cross-session identifiers, there are examples in the past where search engines have released information and took out identifiers like an IP address, but it was the ability to link search queries over time that when you get enough data, as Pam was talking about, you can sometimes go back, and there were examples where people were identified based on this so-called de-identified search data. So we're stripping out the entirety. It's not just the last octet. It's the entirety of the IP address because we wanted to ensure that from a defined point forward, the risk of re-identification of the data was truly gone in a very practical sense. So it's sort of the same stages, different time frames, slightly different methods in some cases, but that's sort of the way we approach it. Whether this should be a standard, it's an interesting question. I think it's useful right now as companies are grappling with this to have companies taking different approaches, see where folks are drawing the lines and striking the balances. I think what we want to avoid is, I think it's not in anybody's interest to take an overly simplistic approach to this where a regulator or somebody might say, well, we'll take Yahoo's time frame but Microsoft's method. Because, that would, create a situation where I think we both agree that the data, we wouldn't be able to achieve some of the essential purposes of collection of the data in the first place. The other point I would make is it truly is a balance. More data we can do more with. We can do more analytics. The more precise it is in terms of being able to link to an individual user, the more sophisticated personalization we could do. And I'll give you one example. If we have data in a personalized or uniquely identifiable way for more than a year, you can do interesting seasonality targeting where, this person searched on these kinds of terms and clicked on these kind of results last year around the holidays, for example, or around Mother's Day. And so you may be able to tailor the results that person would achieve based on the search terms they're entering this year around the same time. We lose a little bit of that if we do these more thorough anonymization techniques earlier than a year. But, maybe that's the right balance to take because we do recognize that the longer you keep the data in a uniquely identifiable form, the greater the privacy risk of even an inadvertent release. Or
I'm guessing there's also something you could be doing for the state. The Commonwealth of Virginia would probably want to use your services for some of their data mining needs, it sounded like.
Let me give you a chance to respond, but also throw a couple of questions into that. There are, and I think Mike was just appropriately touching on, this balance, and I think implicit in that discussion is there are different levels of benefits. Some benefits, like a healthcare, may have, be on the top of benefits. Maybe not, there may be different views on that. There's also different levels of risks. Healthcare data being disclosed, certain types of it may pose the greatest risk versus, generic data that's already available, an address or something like that matter. So I was wondering, in your response, if you could kind of touch upon the degrees of benefits and the degrees of risks, and maybe if you have a position or a view on what's risky or what isn't risky, to share that.
It's a fair question. I'll throw that in the mix. Okay, so just to respond, I think that you have to take a holistic approach to the data. I agree with that. Otherwise, you're just anonymizing or de-identifying one micro data set. That being said, I think that, from a consumer's perspective, there are other questions that we also need to be asking. So, looking at this from a consumer perspective, the question is, okay, well, what are the sensitive attributes that are in this data set? Now, the answer to this question might immediately pop up as SSN or passwords or any of the other things we found in all the AOL data. But when we did our AOL complaint, We re-identified quite a few people without having any of that data. We used what's called auxiliary information or background information, otherwise known today as Facebook profiles and pages. So I think that one of the real complicating factors for consumers is that, you know, the way you usually sanitize a micro data set is you scrub the database of sensitive attributes. IP address as a quasi-identifier is considered by many companies a sensitive attribute. And that's why you see all this activity around, you know, moving the octets around of IP addresses. But I have to tell you, you can take out every IP address in the world, and I promise you that if there's enough correlative information that you can plug into a data set, you can re-identify. And this is really the crux of the what I would call the anonymization problem. If you have enough background data, the research has really shown at this point definitively that there's really a theoretical limit to privacy in a micro data set. So, for example, if you can kind of scrape Facebook and MySpace legally, and then have this lovely database of all sorts of user terms and all sorts of other things, there are algorithms which can allow you to correlate to all sorts of data sets. So the question becomes for consumers, what is a sensitive attribute? And the answer is going to be different for each of us because our lives are different, and what would identify me is not going to identify you. So this makes the problem enormously complicated. And really, one of the solutions is openness and transparency. And so, for example, transparency in this context could potentially look like this. So instead of saying, have you taken out the IP address, a better question is, what sensitive attributes are in this database? Next question would be, what have you done to mitigate the risk of correlation with other databases? And that might be a hash. That might be encryption. It might be security on ever getting that database or data set released in the first place. It can be a lot of things. But then the third question is, what is the verifiable risk for this data? Because each kind of data set has a different risk, and you can assign these risks. And I would really like to see a future where consumers had access to this kind of information, because other than that, there's really no way to determine the level of risk. You really have to rely on the company, and you're not going to know what's in each data set that has your information. It's just not feasible. So you have to rely on some form of transparency to make that happen.
And I think, Anne, it looks like you want to respond.
All I wanted to say is I think that consumer awareness and education is really, really important, because more and more people are broadcasting information about their lives online, and they're doing so with the full intent that it's visible and searchable and available, whether they're using Twitter or Facebook. They're walking, talking, they're exuding data about themselves everywhere that they go, but purposefully, right? But I think that it's a challenge to really make consumers aware, particularly younger consumers, aware about how much of their information is going to linger online and how accessible it's going to be. We've been working hard to try to raise awareness on those fronts and educate consumers through PSAs, and particularly with younger users who come online when they establish a profile, letting them know that, hey, this is going to be out there when you're looking for a job. It's not going to be hard to find information about yourself. So be aware of not just your digital identity, but your digital reputation. Those are things that we're also working on. But I think it's the challenge of an individual managing their data, even if they had access to everything that's out there about them, their ability to understand how it could be used, how it could be accessed, how it could be aggregated and combined is going to be a little bit limited by their technical understanding. So I do think it's a challenge out there for all of us.
And I'm just listening to all of you. It sounds to me that there's also a challenge in that the expectations of consumers are constantly changing as well.
We know that they want personalized services. We know that they want the benefit of a lot of these services. And so we're trying to balance all of these things and being able to provide those services to them, making them aware that it's reliant on a certain amount of information about them. But I think, again, like we've been saying, there's vast benefit to being able to use de-identified data or patterns over time to be able to benefit people without knowing who they are, protecting their privacy. I think but there are always going to be services where, it's necessary to know who you are, to be able to provide you what you want. It's just, I think there's just such a vast amount of information existing in the world, and a lot of it not online, but well, not in digital form, but not from the online world. We are just sort of physical manifestations of all of the data that exists about us.
I'm hearing common themes across the board. I think why don't we turn it now to the audience to see if there are any questions. It's about quarter after, and we've got about another 10 to 15 minutes at most before lunch. Are there questions in the audience? Mark? So Mark's question, if you couldn't hear, is maybe one approach is restrictions on use of the data once people have it. And I'll just add an anecdote. I was struck by Mike's comment is, you know, we also use this data for security, which I think is, you know, one of the benefits under almost any analysis that you want to uphold from multiple perspectives. So I guess the question is, you know, limits on the uses of the data. Maybe we'll go down the line.
I agree that there should be that use should be responsible, and it should be based on providing the services that consumers are looking to get from you. I think collection, limiting collection itself is a challenge because obviously we're, you know, collection is necessary and happens. So I think that reasonable companies should be using data for reasonable purposes, and that's what I think most responsible companies do. I think we've gotten past the era where we can really think about limitations on the collection piece. So I think I agree with you on that front. I don't know.
I do, too. I think, again, privacy has to be thought of as multifaceted. You need to put limits on use where appropriate, recognizing that there are bad actors out there who will not adhere to those limits. That's where it's still useful to think about things like data security and anonymization to ensure that data that can be misused isn't getting out there if it doesn't need to get out there.
And I'll just add one last thing, is that I think what we are always up against is trying to make sure that we're not stifling innovation and our research capacity to be able to offer improvements that we wouldn't have been able to foresee without the use of data. And so research is a pretty broad use, but I think it's one that that fuels a lot of the services that consumers have come to rely on.
Pam?
And then, I think that I agree with you. There is just absolutely no way that you can educate 300 million plus people to an adequate degree to fix all this. That's just not even reasonable to even think about. I think there should be transparency for those who care to be so educated. That ability would be fabulous. We don't have that now. I think we need that. However, in terms of never restricting collection, I actually would take a different position. I do think that there are certain sensitive attributes that should never be collected in the first place. I think genetic data certainly falls in that category. I think Congress has spoken on that, and there's a precedent there. And I think that there are other data that we may want to think about as well, but I think that genetic data is a non-starter.
And if you don't know specifically, but I'd be interested, you or others, you know.
Only halfway through.
Okay.
I finish?
Well, just on that point, though, what are some of those other data elements?
Okay, before I go into those
weeds,
I think getting back to your question, I do think that there needs to be some way of restricting secondary use, which is essentially your question. And I think that one way to do that is to have something that really discusses, you know, the sale of sensitive attributes connected to an individual's identifiable information. So, for example, if company A, bad actor A, and let's be more specific, bad actor A goes into business to collect a bunch of data, and they collect a bunch of sensitive data because you can do it online, and we know that consumers will fall into this. Company A collects a bunch of really sensitive data and then goes off and sells it. we ought to have a law that you know takes care of this kind of bad actor. And I don't think anyone can really find a lot of fault with that. I do think that there are probably other creative ways of restricting secondary use. I think Gina found some of those ways. I think there are other ways as well. But to get back into your question, sensitive information, this is something that we actually have posed to the Federal Trade Commission is what in the context of behaviorally targeted advertising. What is sensitive information? And this is a very tricky question to ask and to try to promulgate answers for. I don't have a definitive answer other than I can definitely tell you I think that the NAI standard that was put forward on medical data was not sufficient and was not
That's actually where I was going to go with this, and I think your observation that it's complex and challenging, I think you're right. I don't think anyone would disagree with you. And one of the things that I understand from the network advertising process is that you know there was a lot of great intention there, and I think actually progress certainly, and you can evaluate. You know, I think there are probably differences of views of how much progress and how fast or wherever. But you know, as you start getting into areas. Take healthcare because I think it makes the point. Not that you know that this doesn't apply in a lot of other areas, but even if you talk about a secondary use, well, if you limit collection of data only to siloed doctors, you limit you know the benefits of treatment and the things you know that's you know apparently national issue number one, two, or three in the presidential agenda. And so I just wonder if you even have a sense, and I throw this back to Ann and Mike, too, on what a, you know, both of you have been through a process trying to identify some of that, and I think, you know, there's some progress there. Even a process for how you get to some of those questions. Anything, Ann, you can offer from your experience?
Yeah, I spent endless hours on the phone with the NAI folks trying to figure out a way to define sensitive, and in particular in the healthcare area, it was very difficult. We had a list that at one point included hair loss, and then hair loss fell off, and because there was some debate about whether that was sensitive. It might be sensitive for women, but maybe not for men, and it was...
It's sensitive, trust me.
So what we were looking for, and I think was really a framework that wasn't about naming a list of conditions. I think we could certainly all agree that HIV/AIDS is sensitive, but is asthma sensitive? Is irritable bowel syndrome, that might be sensitive, but is upset stomach or heartburn sensitive? And I think there were many attempts and lots of conversations actually with the medical community and representatives of the medical community, and I think that was one of the areas that we said, you know what, we have spent a lot of time working on this, and we can't yet come up with a framework, and I think the challenge was that no one has really come up with this, with a framework that works quite like this. So so by all means, we're looking for feedback on that to make that better, but it was just a real, real challenge, and so we acknowledge that there are going to be certain types of attributes that certainly, or at least conclusions that we might draw about consumers in those areas that should be consent-based. But I think we're really still struggling with trying to define a framework that we can all agree upon, given that it's relative to the individual. It's we don't want it to be, if we could define types of conditions, that might be a starting point for healthcare. But I think it was a real struggle for a group of people to come up with that. So experts, welcome.
One more question, Michael.
Eisenberg from MITRE Corporation. I'd just like to ask the panel if the engrossment fairy were to visit one wish on each of you and allow you to get one amendment on the Privacy Act amendments of 2009, what would it be?
I think he something about fairies and tooth fairies and angels, but I'll try and translate, having known Michael for a while. If you had a wish list on, assuming there is, I think he's inferring there'll be some sort of privacy legislation in 2009. What would your what would be on that list?
I'll jump in. You know, we've been an advocate of federal privacy legislation for a number of years, and we would actually like to see a real comprehensive approach to privacy legislation that creates some baseline standards across industries, across the country. And so that would be sort of number one on the wish list. Let's just get a bill passed. What that would look like and what you know we should add to that, I think, is is and will be a very interesting discussion. There's a lot of good models out there. There's even some stuff we can learn from the Europeans, I think. But, you know, Australia, Canada, Japan all have privacy laws that are quite comprehensive that have some very good elements to them that I think are worth looking at, as well as some elements from the sector-specific privacy laws that are out there, like Gramm-Leach-Bliley and perhaps HIPAA.
Pam?
Right. If I could wave that wand, I think is I would shift the debate from a harm-based approach, which is incredibly unhelpful, to a rights-based approach. I think that we've really left the territory of, oh, what harm is this caused, and only if there's harm is there any action. We're living in a digital world, and we had rights in the analog world. I'd like to see some rights in the digital world, and I think that everything will go more smoothly if that would happen. So that would be my wand.
I'll twist it, the wand a little bit for you, Anne, which is assuming there was a law passed. What would be the most important thing you'd want to make sure? Back to the benefits, you know, we had talked about that you'd want to make sure what benefit would be preserved.
Well, I may untwist the wand for a second because I had a thought in mind. And I think prescriptiveness can be helpful, baselines can be helpful, but flexibility, recognizing that technology is a very fast-moving train. And what we're talking about today, and certainly top of mind for a lot of folks, is how do you translate these privacy standards to a web that is not just on your PC, it's on your TV, it's on your mobile device. It has to be flexible enough to consider those different devices and the different types of data that are included there. And it also has to recognize that, you know, if you're too prescriptive, if we had had a privacy law that enshrouded 18 months or 13 months, then companies lose incentive to go to 90 days for anonymization. So I think there are things that you don't want to stifle with legislation, and I think it has to be very carefully considered.
Thanks, and we are certain this discussion and debate will continue for many years to come. Why don't we, before I thank the panel, and we want to do that in one second, just remind everybody we have a networking luncheon. Our keynote address is Josh Silverman, who's the president of Skype, and the Honorable Bob Goodlatte, the co-chair of the Congressional Caucus, will be also a part of that lunch. But let's thank our panel for what I think was a very informative session.